This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Abortion has been a hot-button issue for generations long before Roe v. Wade in 1973. For generations, Christian communities have largely led the charge against abortions and medical access to them. Some doctors point to their faith as a reason not to provide abortion services. You're about to meet one doctor who says his faith compels him to do it. Dr. Willie Parker says his Christian path is the reason he's chosen his career providing abortion services in parts of the South where access can be very hard to come by. He is the author of Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice, and he joins us from NPR in New York. Dr. Parker, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Give us a clearer picture of the exact services you provide. Are you providing a variety of health services and abortion is among them, or do you primarily focus on abortion procedures, clinical counseling, etc.?
Since 2009, I've limited my practice primarily to abortion care to include contraceptive management. I made that decision in part because of the limited access to abortion that women face. It was also coincident with the time where just yesterday it marked the 8th or 9th anniversary of Dr. Tiller's assassination. So I became a full-time abortion provider and I decided that I would leave the other aspects of reproductive health care to women because there are lots of people who will provide the other aspects of care, but when a woman needs an abortion, she has very limited access.
You're talking about Dr. George Tiller, the abortion doctor who was killed in Wichita for providing abortion services.
Correct.
Now, you primarily operate in Mississippi and Alabama, is that right?
No longer Mississippi, primarily in Alabama and Georgia.
Describe your clients to us. What walks of life do they come from? How would you describe them generally?
My clients are like your mother, your sister, your aunt, or your friends. They come from all walks of life. They are primarily reproductive age. Most of them are somewhere between the ages of 18 and 24. Many of them have already given birth, so they know what it means to be a mother. They come from all walks of life, but primarily in the South. Due to higher rates of unintended pregnancy and higher rates of poverty, my clients are primarily women of color and women living in poverty.
Take us back to the moment where your faith began to compel you against your previous views on abortion. Actually, I'm sorry, let's take a step back before that. You said that you previously were anti-abortion, and then your faith journey led you to having more of a pro-abortion stance or pro-abortion access stance. Why were you anti-abortion to begin with? Did you ever think that through in the lens of your faith?
Well, actually, that's a misrepresentation. I was never anti-abortion.
Gotcha.
I was a non-abortion provider. I never challenged a woman's right to make that decision. I was personally conflicted about what it meant to provide abortion care, given my Christian understanding and having to never think deeply or seriously about abortion until I became a women's health provider. And so I lived in places where abortions weren't readily accessible, i.e. in communities where they weren't accessible, as well as during my training, I didn't get any formal training in abortion care. So it was easier for me to punt, if you will, until I was actually in a position where I could have legally provided abortion care. That was the standard of the community. And I had to reconcile what it meant to be a women's health provider and not provide abortion care when I know what happens to women when that care is not available.
Gotcha. So I sorry for misrepresenting. So it wasn't that you were anti and then became pro. You were just kind of neutral, hadn't thought of it, and then kind of came to a decision. Is that more to the point?
That's more to the point.
Gotcha.
I was trying to be neutral on a moving train. Howard Zinn said there's no point in neutrality on a moving train. So I had to decide where I stood.
What prompted that decision? Was there a particular patient that you met, a particular encounter that you had, a moment when you were engaged in your faith and prayer and service and worship, reading the Bible, that led you to begin thinking about this in a different way? Or did it just kind of happen?
It was a situation that I found myself in. I was on faculty at the University of Hawaii in OBGYN department and was one of the supervising physicians in a clinic that provided full scope of healthcare for women to include abortion. And we had an administrator who came on board and who was a sincere Christian who had fundamentalist views. And he decided that it was his prerogative as the head administrator to prevent us from providing abortion care for our patients who had enjoyed access since 1970, as Hawaii was one of the first states to legalize abortion. So this was around 2002. And so I was now for the first time in a situation where a facility and an organization I worked for provided the care, women were getting it, and then we had someone to take that care away. And so now I was in a position of what I was going to do when I faced what I perceived to be an injustice to these women. And so I was on my way home and would often listen to sermons of great speakers or just recordings. And this particular day, I was listening to one of my heroes and mentors, Dr. Martin Luther King, and he described what made the Good Samaritan good. And so for me, that story became very pointed because it suggested what our concern should be when we are in the midst of people needing help. In that story, someone was robbed and left on the side of the road injured, and everybody passed that person by concerned about what would happen to them. The Samaritan in the story that we now know as the Good Samaritan stopped and provided aid. And Dr. King said that what made the Good Samaritan good was reversing the question of concern. And instead of asking what will happen to me if I help this person, he asked what will happen to this person if I don't help him. And I saw myself in that story as a provider. For me, the fallen traveler was pregnant women asking me to help them to resolve unplanned, unwanted pregnancies or wanted, but lethally flawed ones. And so in the context of my Christian understanding, where compassion is the most, is the deepest concern you can have for another person, especially in their time of need, I found myself unable to say no to women when I knew what they faced when abortion wasn't available. So I had to actualize my compassion by acting on the concern I felt for my patients.
We're talking about the intersection of faith and abortion with Dr. Willie Parker, the author of Life's Work. We will continue this conversation and broaden it to abortion access in small town America, rural America, as well as this intersection between faith and abortion. And we welcome your questions, comments, thoughts, perhaps your experiences dealing with the changing face of abortion services in the United States. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Dr. Parker, I wonder how you square your faith with your services, especially because a lot of Christians do not agree with you, at least not outwardly. I mean, one of our listeners, Ricky, wrote on our Facebook page, "That's an oxymoron. You can't be a Christian abortion provider." It seems like the primary argument in terms of having compassion through the Christian lens, at least the Christian political lens, is compassion for the unborn child, the one who is the most vulnerable in this equation. How do you deal with that?
Well, I start from the place of honest disagreement is the beginning of progress, as the Mahatma Gandhi says. And I get it. And I understand why people who hold a traditional understanding of Christianity and who are very rigid in that understanding can't understand how I can see it differently. But that they hold that understanding is primarily a function that they have an ahistoric understanding of how the church has dealt with pregnancy and the life of women and the viability of pregnancy, as well as a very narrow view of what the sacred text says. The Bible says very little, if anything, about abortion. In fact, abortion is never mentioned, as well as the notion of when life begins or whether or not a fetus is more vulnerable than the woman. The woman who's carrying the pregnancy can never matter less than the pregnancy that she's carrying. So I understand how people who hold one understanding of Christianity say that mine is not valid, but I argue that they hold simply that, one understanding. The real irony is that the fact that we have legal abortion now came about as a result of the Clergy Consultation Service in New York City in 1967 openly declaring that they would help women to get access to illegal abortions for safety reasons. And that prompted the state of New York ultimately to legalize abortion as one of the first states. So it's really ironic that now that the most vocal opponent to abortion is people who have a fundamentalist Christian understanding. But the actual initiation to legalize abortion in this country came about as the result of concerned clergy of different faith traditions understanding the value of a woman's life and valuing that over the pregnancy that she might carry.
We're up against a break in just a moment, but I don't want to harp on this, but I know that a lot of Christians would say the Bible says thou shalt not kill, period. And abortion is killing a fetus. The Bible says that before you were made in your mother's womb, I knew you. It seems like the case, the biblical case against abortion is very clear-cut and doesn't require an understanding of history, especially for Christians who view the scripture and take it at face value. What are you seeing, perhaps, that they're not seeing, briefly?
Well, I'm seeing that, it's easy to take scripture out of context. The Bible and the Ten Commandments did not speak about abortion. It talked about murder. And in fact, there are other scriptural passages that talk about when there is a row and a dispute and there's the loss of a pregnancy, that person is not charged with murder. The Bible also, with regard to those texts about I knew you in the womb, that was not talking about abortion. It was not talking about fetal life as we understand it. There was no scientific understanding of how pregnancy and life occur. So I would say that I understand people can take scripture and make it say what they want, but you know, I could also take scripture and form a suicide cult. I can take the passage where somebody hung themselves and then take another verse and says, now go ye therefore and do the same. So biblical literalism is very problematic.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing abortion access with Dr. Willie Parker. Back in April, President Trump signed legislation that lets states block funding to abortion providers like Planned Parenthood. But this could also affect access to other healthcare services that clinics like Planned Parenthood also provide. So let's zoom out a little bit and add some more voices to the conversation. Marissa Evans is a health and human services reporter for the Texas Tribune. She joins us by phone from Austin. Marissa, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Also joining us from Fort Wayne, Indiana, is Dr. Christina Francis. She's the board chair of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Francis, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We do welcome your questions and thoughts and comments and stories about the changing access to abortions in America and abortion services, especially in small town, more rural areas. Please do comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Dr. Christina Francis, what does the association do and advocate? Clearly, pro-life is in the name, but what kinds of activities is the association involved in?
Sure. So at the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, we exist to encourage and also equip our members. We consist of about 4,000 women's healthcare providers nationwide, as well as other concerned medical practitioners to be able to provide an evidence-based rationale for defending the lives of both the pregnant mother and her unborn child. So we exist to distribute information that we have on the research that's been done on the harmful effects of abortion on women, as well as scientific evidence that support the fact that human life begins at the moment of conception.
What would you say is your one strongest piece of scientific evidence against providing abortion services?
Well, I would say that really that would be twofold. The first would be that we do believe that life human life begins at the moment of conception. And this is really, it's supported by science. It's undisputed by embryologists worldwide that at the moment of conception, a living, whole, and distinct human being comes into existence that's completely separate from his or her mother. And so because of that, we, of course, do not support the killing of any innocent human being. And so that would be one reason why we oppose abortion. But the other, and I think equally important reason that we oppose abortion is that there's now a preponderance of evidence that there are some very real harmful effects to women, the biggest ones being an increased risk of preterm birth in future pregnancies after they've undergone surgical abortions. There's now over 150 studies over the last five decades that have demonstrated this. And then there's also well-documented evidence of mental health effects from abortion. So while not every woman is going to suffer from that, there is an approximately six-fold increase in suicide in women who have had abortions, as well as an increased risk of substance abuse and depression and anxiety. And so as healthcare providers for women who desire to practice compassionate medicine for women, just as Dr. Parker does, you know, we are very concerned that our colleagues know this, that our patients know this, so that we can not only empower our colleagues to be able to appropriately counsel their patients, but also empower women to be able to make a fully informed choice when they're either choosing or not choosing abortion.
What evidence do we have that those risk factors after abortion are inherent to abortions themselves, as opposed to related to the environment in which abortions are provided? I mean, if I was a woman who was looking for abortion services in some of the political climates that are in this country, I might come out of the process mentally distressed too.
Well, sure. And that's a very valid point to bring up. Let me address the preterm birth link first. That's the one that I think is most robustly proven. Like I said, there's been over 150 studies now that have proven a definitive link. And even the American College of OBGYNs has acknowledged this between surgical abortions and preterm birth. The biggest study that I think is very, very clear on this that controlled for all other risk factors for preterm birth was a meta-analysis that included over 1 million women that they looked at. So their study size was extremely large, that showed a dose-effect relationship of surgical abortions and risk of preterm birth in future pregnancies. In other words, the more abortions a woman has, the higher her risk of preterm birth in future pregnancies. So if she decides right now that she's not ready for a baby and she decides to have a surgical abortion, but then later on decides that she is ready to either have another child or have her first child, she is at higher risk then of delivering that child preterm, and it's significantly preterm birth. So,
Dr. Francis, I'm sorry to cut you short. I just realized that there's something I should have asked Dr. Parker earlier. Dr. Parker, are the abortions that you provide primarily surgical, non-surgical, or a mix of both?
It's a mix of both. Right now, about a third of women who are eligible for a medication abortion choose that, and that would be an abortion in the first 10 weeks or the first 70 days of pregnancy. But the majority of abortions are surgical.
And I don't want to make this too much an argument about whether abortion is good or bad or defensible or indefensible. That's part of it. But there's more to it that we also want to make sure that we discuss. And Marissa Evans, you've been covering for the Texas Tribune the ongoing fight over abortion services in Texas. We hear a lot about this, but what's the latest right now?
Well, we just finished our legislative session on Monday, actually. So this is when we're kind of doing an assessment of what passed and what didn't pass during the legislative session in the last 5 months. So we have SB 8, which is a combination of ending partial term, partial birth abortions, as well as kind of changes the way medical providers handle fetal remains for research purposes. So ever since the 2015 Planned Parenthood videos came out, there's been a lot more talk about what do researchers do with fetal tissue, and why are our abortion providers, you know, making a profit, if you will, off of selling fetal remains. So that's been a big issue, as well as, you know, in terms of should we be burying them? Should we be selling them for research? So the Texas legislature has been trying to get a handle on that this session. And so we passed a law related to that, as well as, or a bill related to that, as well as we are on board now with banning dismemberment abortions. And so that's basically a surgical abortion procedure. And several other states have already implemented it, but Texas is now one of the latest states to do that. So we're waiting on Governor Greg Abbott to sign off on those bills, and he's very likely to.
I understand, Marissa, that also part of this debate over abortion involves Title 10, some of the funding that mm-hmm. goes toward family planning services. What's the latest with that?
As you mentioned before, President Trump just signed the executive order last month that will allow states to essentially bar certain providers from receiving Title X funding. So that's a big deal here in Texas, because right now Texas is not a Title X grant holder. Planned Parenthood is one of them, as well as the Women's Health Association. Women's Health and Family Planning Association of Texas is the sole grant holder. So they're the ones doling out the funds to Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. So that executive order, you know, it's hard to figure out what that Texas angle is really going to be. But next year, when the state is able to apply to be a Title X grant holder, if they were to get it and be the sole Title X grant holder for Texas, they could very well end funding to Planned Parenthood, Whole Woman's Health, all these other providers that happen to offer abortion services at certain clinics, but not at all of their affiliates. So, you know, the concern is that there will be women who may lose access to reproductive health services, certain types of screenings, because of that. So it's going to really depend on, first of all, if the state applies. They are likely to, but still an if they will apply.
Right.
As well as, you know, what if the federal government will make good on that executive order promise. So this is actually going to be a really big test for the Trump administration in the next year or so of how, if they're really going to allow states to do this and give them the approval to do that.
That's Marissa Evans of the Texas Tribune. We're also spending the hour with Dr. Christina Francis of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, Dr. Willie Parker, and with you, we welcome your questions and thoughts and stories about abortion services in the U.S., particularly the way that the legal fights over abortion and the political fight over abortion services affect small town and rural areas like the ones that Dr. Parker serves. 1A at WAMU.org. Comments on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. A number of the questions surrounding the fight over abortion have to do with the broader impacts on health services. We got a number of comments from listeners who say they're not sure exactly where they would go if they didn't have access to clinics like Planned Parenthood, including this person who left a message in our inbox.
I'm from Norman, Oklahoma, and they have closed the Planned Parenthoods here in Oklahoma. I have a teenage daughter, and I wanted to show her where the Planned Parenthoods were. That is where I suggested what I was going to suggest for her to go to if she didn't feel like talking to me or talking to her pediatrician about contraceptives. And it's where I went when I was a teenager. I do not know where to tell her to go if she doesn't feel comfortable talking with her mother or her pediatrician. So that is a big concern. It has nothing to do with abortion. It has to do with not getting pregnant.
Hey, thanks very much for sharing your story. And by the way, we probably should have mentioned this earlier, but obviously this hour deals with some fairly sensitive stuff. So if you'd rather listen to the rest of this conversation later, maybe away from the kids, you'll find the whole hour online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Dr. Francis, what would you say to that caller in terms of her concerns of not knowing where to tell her daughter to go?
Sure. Well, you know, it's a concern that I've heard from a lot of people. And unfortunately, I think we just need a lot more education for people of, one, the scope of services that Planned Parenthood does provide versus other health centers, as well as the availability of other health centers. So she said she was from Oklahoma. As of the end of 2015, there were 6 Planned Parenthood centers in Oklahoma, and there were nearly 130 federally qualified health centers that provide actually more comprehensive health services to patients than Planned Parenthood does, with the exception of abortion. So, you know, it just in the state of Oklahoma, that's a significant discrepancy in the numbers of clinics that are available. So I would imagine that there would be one available in her town where she could take her daughter, where she would be able to receive not just reproductive health care, but also kind of the full scope of healthcare that she would need, including contraception if she desired that, but also the remainder of her healthcare. One thing that concerns me a little bit about this debate that we have over women's healthcare is that women are kind of being reduced to their reproductive organs. And as women, we are whole human beings that consist of more than just our reproductive organs. So reproductive health is very important. It's very important to me as I care for my patients. But I would much rather see my patients receive services in a location where they can receive comprehensive health care, comprehensive cancer screenings and health screenings in addition to their reproductive care. So
But I wonder though, Dr. Francis, I mean, Planned Parenthood is one of those names that people just know. I mean, I've been to Planned Parenthood. I remember getting HIV testing at Planned Parenthood because it was a place I knew to go. I was not about to go thumbing through the phone book or even Googling it on my shared computer with my parents to go look for some place to go talk to somebody about getting HIV testing. I mean, that's it just feels frightening to have to step outside to some clinic that you don't know.
Sure. And I can understand that. You know, how did Planned Parenthood become that household name? It was through advertising, through word of mouth and things like that. And so, you know, we need to do the same thing with health centers. But why wouldn't we want our children, our sisters, our daughters, our mothers, our aunts, why wouldn't we want them to receive healthcare someplace where they can receive comprehensive healthcare, including contraception, but also, like I said, healthcare that encompasses all of their health and everything that they might need, as opposed to just going somewhere where the scope is very limited.
Dr. Parker, I wonder what you have seen in terms of those other health services. As legislation has cracked down on abortion providers in the areas where you are in practice, do you see that other clinics are stepping up, filling the gap to provide those wraparound services?
Actually, they aren't. And the Guttmacher Institute explored that very question of whether or not community health centers, federally qualified health centers would be able to step up. My first job out of residency was for 3 years. I worked for FQHC in the Central Valley of California. And the reality is where Planned Parenthood often provides services is in places where there is no access. But even in places where there was an overlap of Planned Parenthood facilities and FQHCs, with the closure of the Planned Parenthoods, when they estimated the amount of upscaling that those clinics would have to do, most clinics aren't in a position to absorb the volume of visits and the types of services that they would have to provide. So I think it's really a misdirect with no intention to be contentious. I respect all of the good information that my colleague is giving, but there's been an analysis of the fact that it's just smoke and mirrors, the notion that these other centers would be able to absorb what Planned Parenthood has done. And in stark contrast, Planned Parenthood did provide comprehensive health services in all of the ways that my colleague said that that health centers do. I just think that, you know, it's false advertisement to say that these people who lose their access because they went to Planned Parenthood, part of it was that Planned Parenthood was a trusted provider, but a large part of it was Planned Parenthood was the only place they could go.
And I should clarify, you use the term FQHC. That's a federally qualified health center, right?
We're up against, could I respond to that?
Briefly, we're up against
really
a break,
briefly? Sure. So, and certainly I respect the fact that Dr. Parker works in an area where people are significantly underserved, as do I. However, the federally qualified health centers just 2 years ago had served over 22 million people versus Planned Parenthood that served about 2.5 million. The health centers outnumber Planned Parenthood about 17-1. So I would have a hard time believing that they wouldn't be able to, scattered throughout the country, absorb those patient visits, especially if we redirected the more than $550 million of taxpayer dollars that are going to Planned Parenthood every year to these health centers. So that would certainly give them a boost to be able to take on these extra patient visits.
We're up against a break in a minute, but Catherine emailed, the fallen traveler helped by the Good Samaritan was clearly a human being. The fundamental question I have for Dr. Parker is, does he believe a fetus at any stage is a human being? If so, how can he not render aid as a Good Samaritan to the unborn child? Briefly, Dr. Parker, before we hit a break.
Absolutely, a fetus is a human being because it's conceived by a human being. I've never argued that when women get pregnant, they don't have puppies. But the question is whether or not a fetus is a person. And as a person, it would have equal standing to the woman carrying it. There's no question that a woman is a person. I just simply hold that a fetus has moral weight and a woman has moral weight. They aren't equivalent. A fetus can't be more important than the woman who's carrying it.
Well, we certainly have provoked a very strong reaction from some of our listeners. We will continue our conversation on the other side of this break with Dr. Willie Parker, Marissa Evans of the Texas Tribune, and Dr. Christina Francis of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. We'll continue our conversation, get into more of your questions, and maybe consider the way forward. What is in the future for abortion access in the United States? Stay close. Back now to our conversation about access to women's health care and abortion services with Dr. Christina Francis, Marisa Evans of the Texas Tribune, and Dr. Willie Parker. We've gotten a lot of really strong reactions, and I should first acknowledge that we know that a number of you have written us some very long comments and shared your stories with us. We can't share them all in this hour, but thank you so much for trusting us with your stories. Also, again, this is a fairly grown-up conversation. If you want to listen to this a little bit later when the kids are away from the radio or the computer or whatever you listen on, you'll find the entire hour online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Kathleen emailed us, "My college roommate had an abortion in 1968 on a kitchen table. She was picked up on a corner, blindfolded, taken to a house, and paid $300. She was dropped off on the same corner 30 minutes later. Surely we are not okay with returning to this." Dr. Francis?
Well, I would agree with her. I'm not okay with returning to that. However, I do not believe that the possibility that that might happen should lead us to justify abortion in all cases. I have certainly spent a lot of time with patients who are facing unplanned pregnancies, crisis pregnancies, really, and found themselves in very dire situations. So I certainly don't want to seem like I don't understand where women are coming from when they're in these desperate situations. However, as an OBGYN, I have two patients that I have to think about. I have to think about the mom, and I also have to think about her unborn child. And certainly, I do not feel that if we restrict access to abortion, or if we just hold abortion providers to higher accountability to make them safer for women, that that means that we're going to go back to the era where those types of illegal abortions were being done. However, I also think it's important to note, not that those never happened, but even those who participated in the Roe v. Wade case have acknowledged openly since then that the number of deaths from those type of abortions was greatly inflated for the purpose of the Roe v. Wade case. So I do think we have to be careful when we look at that as an excuse to keep abortion legal or to limit restrictions on abortion. I certainly would not support going back to that.
Right.
But that's why I think a lot more education is needed.
Well, I hear your heart in this. I don't believe you're trying to be heartless in terms of your views on abortion. And I do believe that you as an OBGYN are trying to protect your patients, all of your patients, as you see it. I wonder, though, I want to make sure that we don't paint either of you as the bad guy. I just think that's too blithe. You or Dr. Parker, that's just not it. I do wonder, though, in a real world sense, you know, if a young woman came to you and said, "I am not having this baby. I am going to end this pregnancy one way or another. Will you help me or not?" As a doctor, Dr. Francis, what do you do with that?
Well, and again, that's a situation that I faced, and it's not an easy situation to deal with. And I'm sure Dr. Parker and I have had the same feelings as we've sat and listened to a patient tell us that. I just want to put a scenario in front of you because I think that it helps really put this into perspective of what we're really dealing with when a woman says that. A lot of times when women say that, it's because they're in a situation where maybe they're in poverty or for whatever reason, they don't have the resources to care for a child. So, you know, what if a patient of mine came to me who already had living children, who had born children, and she came to me with her 2-year-old and her 5-year-old and her 8-year-old. And she said, "I can't possibly take care of all 3 of these children. So I need to get rid of one of them. And I really feel like the best way to do that is to end their life. And, you know, I'm not really sure how to do that. And so would you be willing to help me do that?"
Wait a minute. Are you talking about children who are more than, who are already, you're not talking about somebody who says, "I've got 3 kids, I need to get rid of one of them."
I'm talking about born children. I'm going to come to my point of why I bring that up. I mean, it sounds ludicrous. It sounds ridiculous, right? That, I mean, I would say no, and I would probably be, you know, calling a mental health counselor to find out what was going on.
Right.
But, you know, my point in that is Dr. Parker and I both acknowledge that unborn children are human beings as well. But I would argue that there's been no evidence that they are not persons deserving of the same rights that born persons have. They're merely unborn. They're in a different environment than we are, but they are persons just like we do and have every right to life that we do. If you if you say that personhood is based on anything other than the fact that we are human beings, and by my Christian faith, I say that human beings have value and worth because we're created in the image of God. If we base our personhood on anything other than that, then it's something that we don't share equally, right? So it's something that born people have more of than unborn people, and that's why they have more personhood. But that doesn't just end after birth. If you base it on things that other people have tried to base it on, like the ability to have conscious thought or the ability to feel pain, then there's also differences between born people in those things, and therefore not all born people would have the same right to life. And so that's why I brought that example up.
Well, let me interject right there.
We would have to handle it in the same way.
I think the aspect of the humanity of the unborn is really at the heart of a lot of the opposition to this. I'm
right.
A little shocked by your example about the parent who's trying to get rid of one of their three born living children, but I think I see what you're getting at.
Sure.
However,
and I was
however,
being a little bit over the top, but just to try to illustrate the point.
That's actually way over the top, and it's not to the question that this woman raised, but we got to move on because I think you are making a point in there about human life that really is at the heart of the opposition and that a number of our listeners have chimed in on. John tweeted us, abortion ends a human life. It's an injustice to that child. It's a poverty that society has convinced women it's an acceptable option. Another listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, the euphemisms are silly. Abortion is the opposite of reproductive health care. And Tom wrote us on Facebook, defund Planned Parenthood? Yes. Why should I be forced to support these butchers? Dr. Parker, what would you say to them?
Well, I, you know, bombast and hyperbole are, they are what they are. I think my colleague and I've read the statement of what APLOG supports, and two out of the three things that are essential to what they say, I agree with. They say that they advocate for the life of the unborn child. We disagree there, but they also advocate for informed consent for women about abortion, and as well as the right for physicians to follow their conscience, convictions, and regarding referring or doing abortions. I think where we differ is I simply don't believe that I ever have to advocate with a woman against her own interest. If that woman comes to me and desires to end a pregnancy, either I have to decide that she's not capable of the moral reasoning that'll led her to do that, as well as the intellectual capability to look at her life and to decide what's best for her. I think that's where we differ. And I think what to me constitutes personhood, and that's different about whether or not an unborn or a pregnancy is equal to the woman carrying it. When a woman presents to me, she's asking me to act on her behalf. I simply choose not to weigh the interest of the pregnancy that she's carrying over her. And so I understand how it's easy to make labels and to paint people who do abortions or even women who have them as being horrific, but I simply beg to differ.
There are also a variety of views on this that seem to see some of the nuance in all of this, and there is a great deal of nuance. Danica wrote on our Facebook page, I am an Alabama birth doula, and these are real issues for women I support. As a woman and as a woman of color, I feel attacked by my Christian faith when it comes to reproductive health. Thank you for this honest discussion. Lane tweeted us, I'm definitely pro-life, pro-adoption, pro-take care of them after they're born, too, and pro-conception. We also got a message from a woman who says she does not support abortion, but she does support Planned Parenthood, and she left a note in our inbox.
My name is Margaret, and I live in Sylvania, Missouri, and I'm very pro-life. I'm very much against abortion, but I love Planned Parenthood. I don't know what I would have done without them, because when I was young, for 15 years, I was trapped in a very abusive marriage. And I would have had a lot of children that would have been very abused, and I don't know what I would have done without Planned Parenthood. God bless Planned Parenthood. Thank you.
Margaret, I appreciate you leaving the message. Marissa Evans, I wonder if in your reporting for the Texas Tribune, it's this Planned Parenthood thing that seems to drive things in one direction or another. There's so much cultural baggage around the institution of Planned Parenthood, good, bad, or otherwise, that everyone's got such a strong opinion about it, and it just kind of makes it hard to have a level-headed conversation about all this.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'm listening to both of the doctors talk, and it's just such a visceral, controversial, and personal issue, and it's so circumstantial. You know, Dr. Francis talked about, you know, she's not sure. You know, she has to think about her own scope of practice. She has to think about her own views on this issue when a woman comes to her. And then you also have, you know, someone who's also saying, well, you know, I'm going to help her as much as I can because of compassion. So it just really depends. And I think with Planned Parenthood, you know, it's that brand name recognition, as we've all discussed earlier. You know, yes, there are community health centers that exist, but, you know, people recognize the Planned Parenthood logo. They recognize the pink or the blue, depending on where you live. And so I think that's what makes it difficult, particularly here in Texas, when we are trying to create our own women's health programs and trying to get more women to trust these programs, but they don't have the brand name recognition yet. And it's a matter of word of mouth. It's a matter of, you know, how do we help women understand the services that they are eligible for? So I think that's another big issue. And in terms of how women of color are affected, I mean, I also cover the child welfare system here in Texas. And so oftentimes when I've talked to reproductive health advocates and even anti-abortion activists, they have talked about, you know, black women are more likely to get abortions than any other group. And, you know, we need to save the black babies. And as someone who covers child welfare here in Texas, we have been trying to do a major overhaul and reform of how we take care of vulnerable kids. You know, it's one thing to want a black child to be born, but, you know, it's also another issue, too, if they do wind up in our child welfare system and they are unwanted, they're not most likely to be adopted or find a foster home right away. And they might actually grow up in the state's care because no one wants them. So it's such a multifaceted issue here in Texas because it's so connected to not just Planned Parenthood, but the larger issue of, okay, if a woman does carry a baby to term, what services are available to her for her, not only for her postpartum care, but also for the child. Right. So it's just really multifaceted.
We're low on time for the hour, but I want to get in at least one more comment. Terry emailed us, as a primary care provider, I had a patient whose life was endangered at her 8th week of pregnancy due to a cardiac condition. Unfortunately, she was seen and admitted to a Catholic hospital where terminations were not done. One of the OB residents, the obstetrics residents, called and urged me to have her transferred immediately. Luckily, we were able to transfer her to another facility where the procedure was performed, and she recovered and returned to her family, which included 2 teenage children. Terry, thank you for that email. Dr. Willie Parker, as we're running out of time this hour, I wonder what you see as the future for all of this going forward. Clearly, Terry's email shows that this is a whole network of belief systems and policies that affect a woman's access to abortion services. Where do you think all this is going?
It'll depend on to what degree people who understand the importance of this being of abortion being health care and that it saves women's lives, that 1 in 3 women in this country will need that care, to the degree that they engage politically and push back on the politicizing of women's health. Abortion is health care. Women need that care. And the only way we're going to preserve access to that is to get involved politically and to push back on this effort to delegitimize the health care that women need.
Andrea wrote us via email, I don't know about Oklahoma, but here in Ohio, not only do community health clinics not provide comprehensive health services to women, but they refer women with reproductive health questions and issues to Planned Parenthood. Another one of our listeners wrote via email, why is it anybody's business whether or not I have an abortion? Why does anyone get to tell me what to do with my body? If you don't want to have an abortion, don't. But don't try to keep other women from having access. Thanks again to everybody who shared their stories and their thoughts with us. We know this is really hard to talk about, but thank you for being forthright. Dr. Francis, I know we're low on time, but I wonder about your views on all this. You know, we started with Dr. Parker and his faith views. You've alluded to the fact that your faith also kind of leads you against supporting abortion. I wonder if maybe you should be a little more forthright with that as the core of your arguments. I mean, the medical research that I've seen says that women are far more likely to die during childbirth than during an abortion. The statistics we can kick back and forth all day, but ultimately you're a Christian. You're a person of faith. And Dr. Parker has just come out and said, I'm a Christian and my Christian faith leads me to believe this about abortion. It seems like that's maybe the braver path. Why don't you do that?
Well, for those people who know me, I have never been quiet about my faith and the fact that is even what compelled me to practice medicine and practice compassionate healthcare. So forgive me if I, you know, didn't say that at the outset, but
that's
but
okay. That's, I mean, and you didn't owe me that at the outset. So that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been quiet about that. And that really is a big part of, again, why I value human life the way I do from the moment of conception until natural death. So my faith is certainly what compels me. I think I feel obligated and compelled to share the scientific data that's out there and the medical data that's out there, because oftentimes that can be misquoted or left out. Actually, you know, the study that you're quoting that showed that women are far more likely to die from pregnancy is actually based on bad numbers. There's multiple countries that have actually shown a decrease in maternal mortality when abortion numbers have decreased. So, you know, I don't feel like as a Christian and as a pro-life physician that I'm endangering my patients in any way by not recommending abortion to them. But absolutely, my faith in Jesus Christ and my understanding of the Bible leads me very clearly to support life. As you said, the Bible tells us very clearly not to kill, not to commit murder. And though it doesn't say anything, use the word abortion, there are many things that we know to be wrong according to our Christian faith, even though the Bible doesn't explicitly say that they are wrong because of the principles that we learn through our faith. We are told in Proverbs to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. And I truly feel like the unborn are those that really have the least ability to speak for themselves. And so that's what I'm here to do.
Well, I appreciate you speaking your mind this hour. I really appreciate all three of you taking part in a challenging conversation. That's Dr. Christina Francis, the board chairman for the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Francis, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marissa Evans is a health and health services reporter for the Texas Tribune. Thank you, Marissa.
Thank you.
And Dr. Willie Parker is an abortion provider and the author of Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, I appreciate you sharing your story, sir. Thanks very much.
It was my pleasure.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.